KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, I'm a paleo nut, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nut.
Hey, Ray!
David, I'm here in Kansas still.
I can tell by the echo of the old farmhouse room you're
yes,
in.
Yes, I actually am in the old farmhouse room that was next to an old hotel that's been torn down. It's an old house. I'm in Lester Raymer's house, and it's really exciting here in Lindsborg because Little Sweden USA is about to celebrate Hillingsfest, which is a Swedish parades and all the children are dressing up.
Right.
So
I got some paleo news.
Oh, paleo news, yes. Prehistoric stuff.
Do you know what a water bear is?
I do.
Yeah, a water bear is a very non-scientific name for a...
Well, a little creature that lives in the ocean. They're microscopic, and it's one of those things that you're about to tell me. You know more about this.
It's a tardigrade.
Tardigrade, that's it.
But they don't just live in the ocean. They live everywhere. They live on a blade of grass. They live in your carpet. They live, they're worldwide.
On my body, maybe?
I don't know if they live on your body. I think those are the lice that I keep seeing you scratching. But in your beard, those things falling out of your beard. No, a tardigrade is this little tiny thing. When you look at it, it looks really cute. But when you look at it under a microscope, it's very alien looking.
Mind-blowing.
It has four legs and a strange flower-shaped mouth.
Kind of reminds me of the creatures from Dune or something like that, you know?
These things have been found to survive the vacuum of space.
Right.
They can survive being dried out and desiccated and then revive. They're pretty much indestructible.
Yeah, wow. And?
They just found one.
Yes.
In amber. Everything is in amber now. It's incredible. They found a tardigrade in 16 million year old amber. And guess where this amber is from? It's always from the...
Mongolia.
No.
Morocco.
Dominican Republic. I don't know why the amber comes from
the
there.
The DR? Wow.
So it is the third fossil tardigrade from the Miocene. It's the oldest one, and that's pretty cool.
So they've been rare in the fossil record then now.
Very rare. Well, they're so small. They're tiny. Like if you were to take, I saw a picture of a penny, an American U.S. penny, with a little tiny block of salt, right? You know how salt crystals are square.
Yeah.
And that was like sitting next to Lincoln's shoe on the little tiny Lincoln on the back of the penny inside the Lincoln Memorial. And below that little tiny square of salt was this tardigrade to show you how small they are.
You know, actually, while you were talking about that, I just flashed on going down memory lane here. But I remember when my mom got me a microscope. As a kid.
Oh.
And I started, and I was just so fascinated by all the cool stuff. And I would take salt and spiders.
Oh, right.
You know, and just look at all the incredible things. And actually, I want another microscope in my life. But yeah, it's cool.
I bought one when my son was about 8, and I still have it. I pull it out all the time. It's a stereoscopic, and I've got, slides and slide covers and everything to look at my pond scum, which is pretty awesome.
That's right. Hey.
Speaking of
pond scum. Yes. You're about
to
diss me again, aren't you?
No, it has. Well, yeah.
Come on.
It has nothing to do with pond scum, but our guest today is a book that you recommended I read, and just the title of it, I went, oh my God, I can't wait. And that is.
The Ends of the World. The Ends of the Multiple Ends of the World.
It's so apocalyptic, but it's the massive extinction events that have already happened.
Yeah, we have been through 5 mass extinctions, maybe a few more, but 5 just like things where the planet just kills everything, man, and it's...
Yeah, I mean, we're talking life in the ocean, life on land. I mean, it's phenomenal, the amount of mass death. And the fact is that these species that died out didn't come back, a lot of them.
Many meet their end, and that's it. you know, so
that's it.
Many groups so of life animals. Seems... Yeah. So life is cruel. Life. I mean, you read this book, it's like, whoa, we are lucky to be here.
So now this is an interview where I was not there because the writer of this book, Peter Brennan, was driving through Lindsborg, Kansas. You snagged him as he went by the intersnake.
It turns out he's actually moving back east from Boulder, Colorado. He literally had his belongings stuffed in the car, and he stopped here.
I can't wait to listen to this because I wasn't there.
You weren't there, and actually, you don't allow alcohol on the set, but when Peter and I were here, we had a couple beers. You can maybe hear them in the background. All right, well,
hopefully that'll make the two boring old men colorful.
It was a great interview. It's so cool to be able to read a book, finish a book, call the author. He's like, well, I could be there in 2 days, and boom, he was here.
That's so cool.
No.
All right, well, let's start your tape recorder. And remember those tape recorders?
Yeah, the Reel Reel.
Yeah, let's start it up, and here we go.
All right. I am sitting here in Lindsborg, Kansas, and I've just finished a really cool book, The Ends of the World by Peter Brannan. And so conveniently, Peter has driven through here. He's here. He's here tonight. Like, and this is so cool, Peter. Like, finish a book, call the author, and he's here.
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out.
No, I really enjoyed your book. I took my time with it, and I have sticky notes all over the place, and you know, but I was underlining like crazy as I read this thing. It's so well written, it's so compelling, but it's the story of the ends of the world, the five previous extinctions, and it also explores the idea of whether or not we're going through an extinction right now. But before we get into that, I just want to ask you, Peter, are you a paleo nerd?
I am definitely a paleo nerd.
You confess to it right now.
I do, I confess.
All right, how did it start? Tell me.
How did it start? I think it was reading books by Walter Alvarez, T-Rex and the Crater of Doom. And Peter Ward wrote some books in the early 2000s about the Permian mass extinction. And I'd always, as a kid, I was a huge dinosaur nerd and read Jurassic Park.
You read Jurassic Park?
I read Jurassic Park.
Before the movie came out?
It was right when the movie came out.
Right when the movie came out.
Yeah, it was like 1993 or something.
So you're an East Coast guy, but you're kind of Jurassic Park generation in a way.
Yeah. I mean, 40s. No, that movie was a huge, huge deal to me.
Well, so you're a writer. You're actually a professional writer. Yeah. And I'm a professional artist, and you've been managed to live off of words, and I live off of pictures, which is kind of cool. But how did you convert your? I mean, you still love dinosaurs, right?
Oh yeah, I think I've been a little brainwashed by some of the like Paleozoic invertebrate people that now I can I can appreciate a brachiopod just as much as a T-Rex.
Oh, so you came around.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Give me your backstory.
So I kind of fell away from my obsession with paleontology as a kid for a while. And then I was a science journalist working in New England, writing a lot about the ocean. When you write about the ocean, you find out that a lot of kind of stuff's going wrong in it. Overfishing, nutrient pollution, and future things like ocean acidification and climate change and all this kind of depressing stuff. But I was doing that, and I had this fellowship at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution for science journalists. And it was only a week long, but I managed to find some researchers who were doing some really interesting stuff on the PETM, which is this thing 56 million years ago, the Paleocene, Eocene thermal maximum.
Thank you for defining that. What, they're working on the PETM at the Woods Hole?
Yeah, because so people study it by looking at fossils on land, but one of our best, sort of most illuminating records of that event is from deep sea sediments and all around the world. Yeah, so you can see in the sediments that...
We're drinking beer here, it's on the record. But so you go to the bottom of the ocean to actually find out how warm the world was 55 million years ago.
Well, what you see is this incredible sort of stack of sediments that are mostly chalky because they're made out of plankton that calcify, things that are called coccolithophores. And they, so you have this really chalky kind of sediment that goes and goes and goes. And then there's this really stark line in it where it just becomes clay for 250,000 years and then becomes chalky again.
Something
happened there. Like, just like when you see the sort of clay layer in Italy that the Alvarez has made famous with the dinosaur extinction. With this event, you also see this really dramatic record in the in sort of life that was laid down at the bottom of the sea. And what happened was a lot of CO2 came out of the North Atlantic probably and made the planet about 5 to 9 degrees warmer. And the CO2 reacted with the seawater, which makes it more acidic. And that's why you have this sort of line in the deep sea sediment. It changes from sort of chalky calcium carbonate to clays for, and it takes 200,000 years or so for the ocean chemistry to recover. So
you're a teenager, you look into this stuff.
Well, this was in my 20s when I was already a full-time journalist and sort of being introduced to this idea that the things that we're worried about in the future, like climate change and things, aren't just these theoretical things in computer models, but you can actually go to rocks and study really ancient events when the planet kind of ran the same experiment that we're running now. So I thought that was
the planet ran the same experiment that we're running now.
Yeah, and I just thought that was such a cool way into the topic that I hadn't really seen that much written about, so I sort of just got obsessed after that.
Well, all right, so you are a kid growing up in the Boston area. You go up, you quickly became a journalist. I mean, that's kind of a... But you're writing for pretty prestigious journals now, things like the Atlantic, the New York Times.
Yeah, I started working...
How is it... I mean, you're a wordsmith that just jumped into writing about... I'm getting into your backstory.
Yeah, here. I mean, I always loved reading science nonfiction, so it was sort of in the back of my mind that that's something that I'd want to write. I started out writing for a small community newspaper and then sort of started pitching stories to bigger and bigger outlets and things sort of snowballed.
So you wanted to make a living as a writer?
Yeah, for sure.
But you had this deep love of paleontology.
Well, a love that I rediscovered probably 10 years ago or so.
So, but you began to realize that there's something going on in the planet and you have become an expert in extinctions now. A self-taught expert in extinctions?
Yeah. I mean, I like to think that I am just communicating the work of scientists rather than myself.
Right. You're the messenger.
Yeah, right. Some scientists are really good at science communication, but sometimes there's sort of a...
Some are, I would say.
Yeah.
Actually, that's my job, too, is helping to
right.
explain.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're not the best communicators, really, but...
I don't want to tar them all with that brush, but...
I think we can, maybe, a little bit. I don't know. That's why there's jobs in doing what we do.
Right,
But you really have become, like, a messenger for a lot of the research that's going on and the relevance of paleontology.
Yeah.
Because I think we're all seeing that, aren't we? Paleontology was suddenly within the last, I mean, I'm almost 70 years old here, but the relevance of it is like the what is the planet doing now? And if we look to the past, we can see stuff. I want to go through each extinction with you.
Okay, sure.
But I realize that you worked early on the PETM, the Paleocene, Eocene, thermal maximum, which is when the planet was as hot as it's ever been.
Yeah.
From what we know, it was
really hot, yeah.
Why isn't there an extinction event there?
That's a great question and an open area of research.
I mean, when the planet was just blazing
hot. Yeah, it was really warm.
And when I look through the list of extinctions, there's nothing that happens between the Paleocene and the Eocene. It's like, did everybody just, everything just comfortable?
Yeah, there were some extinctions in that event, but you're right. It's nothing like the big extinctions that I write about in the book. And there's actually more so than extinction, that event is more famous for sort of just being this lightning bolt to evolution where you suddenly get the beginnings of all these mammal groups that...
Right. If anything, it's known for its expansion of life.
Right. So why wasn't it as lethal?
Because that's when we see the whales take off, the mammals off. Fish diversify like crazy. I'm a fish freak.
Yeah.
And after the asteroid hits and the Deccan traps and all that, fish diversify. They go from the ammonites are out of the way and fish go crazy. Yeah. Mammals go crazy because the big dinosaurs are out of the way.
Yeah, but it takes a while. So it takes like 10 million years and then there's the PETM and then there's really a big radiation. It's pretty weird. Some people explain the not being an extinction. Maybe it's because these things, large igneous provinces, which are these massive continent scale volcanic events that cause a lot of the mass extinctions that I write about in the book. Maybe they're worse if they happen on land than underwater. So this one might've been underwater because volcanoes on land also put all sorts of terrible stuff into the atmosphere, like mercury and chlorine and fluorine and all this other stuff. But it also could be that the planet's gotten more resilient since the really big mass extinction 252 million years ago. There wasn't modern calcifying plankton, which for complicated reasons might make the ocean more susceptible to oxygen loss. I mean, these are pretty...
You're saying that maybe the planet is getting more resilient in some ways?
In some ways, that might be true. In the first 250 million years or so of animal life, you find black shales everywhere. It seems like the oceans aren't as oxygenated as the modern. And that might just be because of that might have gone away in the past, in more recent geological history, because there are these biological innovations that are really changing how things are, geochemical cycles work on the planet. But I don't need to get into that. The other thing is, like, Pangaea might have been an especially bad time for this to happen, for other reasons we can get into.
Let's circle back around to The Ends of the World, the book itself. And so it sounds like you got your writing chops, but then you got this idea for this book. And what is the book about?
It was partly motivated by the fact that I had heard this discussion about, are we in the sixth mass extinction?
Everyone wants to know, is it now?
Yeah, right. But that was always sort of just left as assumed that everyone knows there's five mass extinctions. And I knew about the dinosaur one, and I knew some about the big Permian one, but I wanted to...
I didn't know there was five before. I thought, I knew about two, but...
Right. Well, sometimes it's just sort of mentioned offhand that there are five. And I thought, well, I want to read a book about these five mass extinctions. And I went to libraries and bookstores looking for that book, and I didn't really find one that covered all of them written for a popular audience.
So is that how you pitched it? Is that how you pitched it? Your publisher?
That and
your agent? Or?
Yeah, that and the fact that I think that there has been this interesting sort of development in the last 30 years of mass extinction research, where in the 80s and 90s, sort of asteroids dominated the conversation because of the discoveries of the impact layer in 1980 and the crater in the early 90s. But that in the last 30 years, as researchers went around the world looking for evidence of asteroid impacts at the earlier mass extinctions, thinking they were going to find it, they didn't at any of the other mass extinctions.
Oh, so when the Alvarez father and son, right?
Yeah.
What year was that?
So that was 1980.
So 1980. In 1980, we're kind of getting this a little bit backwards. I kind of wanted to walk through them all.
Yeah, we can do that. We can do that too.
But there began to be like, oh, it was asteroids. That's what did it. Let's look at all these other extinctions.
Right, and they didn't find any.
They were looking for asteroids at all the other extinctions.
And even the most hardcore sort of asteroid proponents would admit, like, I've been studying the Devonian or the Permian for a long time, and I have not found any impact layer, kind of. So what could it be? And in the last few decades, there's been this sort of interesting development that it seems like big climate changes that are related to a lot of the things that we're worried about today turn out to be really important in some of these mass extinctions. So I thought there was a noose hook to the story too.
Well, let's just back up for a moment. When we look at the fossil record, we know there's big skips and big gaps in the fossil record. It's not so easy to dance to the fossil record because every now and then there's a big chunk missing, but... Right. How do we know that there was an extinction event? I mean, just basically looking at the fossil record, how do we know, like, oh, there's a change here?
Yeah, I mean, it requires collecting tons and tons of fossils all over the world so that you finally have enough that you can say something meaningful about them.
And so there was data. And that data is fossils.
Yeah, and people even debate. So the biggest mass extinction ever, again, I'm jumping ahead here, but for a long time, people didn't think there was an extinction there, but they just thought there was a lot of rock missing. And then
the Permian Triassic we're talking about, PT. Yeah,
right. And then there were sort of calculations like, well, how much rock would have to be missing for this not to be an extinction? It was just like, no.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about the fossil record, because you have to look at what kind of things fossilize, number one, because not everything fossilizes. Yeah. I like some of the points you make in the book. It's like, well, there's big...
Yeah, right.
There's areas that don't really have deposition, so therefore you don't get fossils from that.
Right.
But there's an accumulation of time, and in the fossil record, some stuff is eroded, and there's just not a lot of good records right where these big events happen.
Right.
And then there seems to be a bias because hard, shelly things like brachiopods and clamshells. But when you see those really durable things disappear, something big happened, right?
Yeah, I mean, the last few hundred years, we've lost a lot of big charismatic mammals, but you wouldn't really know it from the mean, some invertebrates have gone extinct, but they are really hardy. For even the clams to go start going extinct, it really has to be hitting the fan.
Well, let's go back.
Sure.
So there are five. And when I...
Well, even that's now kind of up for debate.
People. Well, I know. I talked... We had Peter Ward on the show once, and Peter said, there's a lot more than five.
Yeah, yeah.
And his whole thing is the Medea hypothesis that, you know, versus Medea versus Gaia.
Right.
Gaia being sort of the hippie thing, the earth will heal itself. And he's like, no, the earth, Medea, is the bad mother that wants to kill us.
Right.
Which is like, okay. But let's go back to the first one.
Planet is 4.5 billion years old. The first, like, well-accepted fossil life is 3.5, I think.
Right, one life shows up. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, but what's amazing is that you don't get animals until only around 600 up to 550-ish million years ago. So for about 3 billion years, the only most interesting thing going on the planet is pond scum. And then...
Pond scum, the boring billions,
yes. Well, the boring billion, yes. And then you get these crazy snowball Earth events. But then finally you get animals, and that's really... Once you have animals, you can start having mass extinctions, really, because they're specialized and they are easier to kill than bacteria, basically.
Right, but they're needy.
Yeah, they're needy.
Animals need more things.
Right.
Plants need more things.
Yeah, so I sort of start the book with a bonus extinction right at the beginning, because there's sort of this weird...
We threw in one more.
Yeah. There's this weird sort of gelatinous world before the Ediacaran. And that
before
seems,
the Ediacaran.
No, the Ediacaran. And that seems to all get wiped out at the Cambrian explosion when you get all these bizarre lobster-looking things and...
Swimming taco shells.
Yeah, all those aliens that show up at the beginning of the Cambrian. There might actually be a mass extinction of these weird sort of jelly creatures before that. So I throw that in. That's not actually usually considered one of the so-called Big Five. The first of the Big Five mass extinctions is the Endordovician mass extinction 445 million years ago. So this is a world that's hundreds of millions of years before Pangaea even assembles, and hundreds of millions of years before dinosaurs. So this is a really alien planet, and it's sort of dominated by weird squid-like things and shells and trilobites. And
it's a trilobite heyday.
Yeah, yeah.
I like to say the Ordovician, they were like...
Yeah, there were
sweet city, you know.
And there were weird ones too. There were pelagic trilobites, so they're like just swimming through the seas. We sort of think about them as these, like, I think I call them Roombas in the book.
I like that description of them as Roombas.
Yeah, so it's called the sea without fish in the Ordovician, which is kind of an overstatement because there are fish. They're just not very important, and they're really
right.
simple. And the world's dominated by these big weird invertebrates. And then it's possibly the second biggest mass extinction ever at the end of the Ordovician.
Well, actually, when I invited you here to talk with me here in Lindsborg, actually in my fossil coastline book, I'd done a drawing of the six mass extinctions. Mm-hmm. We'll debate the sixth one in a moment here, but I wrote down my understanding as best I could get it. For the Ordovician, I wrote, and you can tell me as we go along here if I have it right or not. At the end of the Ordovician, as we entered the Silurian, about 444 million years ago, ice age, glaciation,
right.
sea levels drop, brachiopods and trilobites take a major hit.
Yeah, that's a pretty, that's a pretty good summary of it.
There's an ice age.
Yeah, there's evidence for...
How do we know there's an ice age at the end of the Ordovician?
Well, I think it's kind of amazing that... So I'm from New England, where if you hike around Maine or New Hampshire, you can see on the rocks these things called glacial striations, which are sort of just these scratch marks in the, like, yeah.
The glaciers.
Like fingernail marks in the rocks that were left there by the advance and retreat of really recent ice sheets at the end of the last ice age, only a few thousand years ago. And at the end of the Ordovician, it's so long ago that the Sahara Desert was not a desert. It was over the South Pole at the time. And in the middle of the Sahara today, you can find the same sorts of glacial striations that you find in New England in the middle of the rocks in the middle of the Sahara, but they're from the end of the Ordovician.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's all this evidence for ice all over the planet at the end of the Ordovician. And there's more wonky stuff, too. Like, you can look at...
So we know there was ice, just what? Because there was scraping.
Yeah, there's like a lot of the same land features you see in parts of North America from the really recent ice age, you can find from this time 445 million years ago. And there's other ways too. There's paleontology. I think people might have this idea of sort of this old fashioned science of people just dusting off bones in the back of a natural history museum. But the people I talk to are doing all this really pretty technical research, looking at isotopes and things in fossils. And you can, if you know how to tease out the record from the isotopes, you can also sort of reconstruct.
Isotopes are basically the chemical signature of a living creature, right? I mean.
Hey, Ray and Peter, I'm not in this awesome interview, but I can shed some light here on what an isotope is. An isotope is an atomic element with similar chemical makeup, but with different atomic weights. You've heard of carbon-12 and carbon-16. They're isotopes of carbon. Now, unstable isotopes undergo spontaneous decay during which they emit radiation until they achieve a stable state, and this can happen over tens of thousands of years. It's called a half-life. This property of radioisotopes is useful in food preservation, archaeological dating of artifacts, geological dating of rocks and strata, and most awesomely, for medical diagnosis and treatment. There's the short answer. Mr. Wikipedia can help you listeners dive down deeper. Carry on, gents.
I was talking about these sort of planktonic things that build their shells out of calcium carbonate earlier, but
right.
Clamshells do the same thing, and oysters and scallops and brachiopods. So you can find fossils where they're made out of calcium carbonate, but they make those shells out of the water around them. So they record what the chemistry of the ocean is 445 million years ago in their shells.
Okay.
And
the data is there in their shells.
Yeah, and it can be because they're so old, there's a lot of discussion about whether it's still a reliable signal, but there's ways of kind of working around that.
Can we extrapolate what the oxygen level?
Oxygen is tough to get. There are.
Well, I remember talking with Peter Ward. He was talking about oxygen levels in these different areas. Like, well, how do you know what the oxygen is doing?
Oxygen's harder to reconstruct. There are some interesting ways of. So we know it was really high, for instance, this weird time when there were giant bugs, because bugs can only get so big when there's high oxygen. So that's kind of.
The big bugs happen in the Carboniferous.
But Right. But that's just like kind of a. And there's a lot of charcoal everywhere in the Carboniferous because forest fires would have just been out of control because oxygen was so high. So that's sort of a crazy way of figuring out that there's a lot of oxygen.
All right. So let's get back.
Yeah.
We're
getting off track a little.
Well, you could keep me on track too, Peter. We'll blame the beer on that. We just had a couple nice cheeseburgers, by the way.
So
how do we know? So the ice is around the planet, the glaciation, we see the fossil records suddenly change, right? I mean, there's suddenly a lack and things
are
different.
Yeah. The traditional explanation for this extinction is that before it, you have the continents are really flooded with really high sea levels, and that is providing a lot of habitat for all these creatures and these sort of shallow seas that are covering all the continents. So I went to Cincinnati, Ohio for the book, today is in the middle of the country, but it's sort of the best place on earth to see this world from 450 million years ago, because it was flooded with these shallow seas along with almost the rest of the entire continent and a lot of the other continents. So you can imagine if you put a ton of ice on Africa all of a sudden and you drop sea level by hundreds of feet, you're kind of draining all these shallow seas on top of the continents, and maybe you're destroying a lot of habitat that these animals like. What's interesting, though, is even animals in the deep, it seems like, are going extinct in this mass extinction. So that might have to do with the fact that the ocean circulation is changing and the oxygenation of the ocean is changing. And, you know, animals can keep up with slow change, but if you sort of just change the whole structure of the ocean really quickly...
Everybody's trying to play catch up all at once, and not everybody plays. Yeah, it doesn't.
Right.
My little drawing here says 86% loss of.
It's something like that, yeah. In the aftermath of this, actually, there's a radiation of fishes too, where
it's the age of fish.
Yeah, where you go.
We
from
get
this...
into the Silurian, into the Devonian, and in the Devonian, we know it's frequently called the age of fish because that's when my fishy brethren were really. Diversifying, there's every kind of funky weird fish, including our ancestral fish.
Right.
The lobe fins are doing really well. Actually, the placoderms, the Devonian, the big placoderms. The placoderm is
A placoderm is a really, well, I mean, the biggest most famous version of it is Dunkelosteus, which is this really scary, like bus-sized fish with these self-sharpening guillotine blades for teeth.
I like that.
Yeah, but they were just encased in basically armor.
But at the end, so number two, we suffer late Devonian, 75% loss. And what I wrote down here was a low oxygen crisis causes a huge biotic crisis. Placoderms go extinct. And this is a series of extinction events that happen at about, looks like 375-ish, yeah.
So, yeah.
And the placoderms go extinct. Reef systems throughout the world take a major hit, and sea levels drop dramatically, and maybe there's a series of events is what I'd written on my little...
Well, sea level seems to be going up and down like pretty frequently, and there might even be a rise during a big mass extinction. So,
well, what gets screwed up in the Devonian?
The Devonian's really weird.
What's the culprit?
Yeah.
Something's going on.
Yeah. So the placoderms get hit really hard in this big pulse of extinction at 375, but then they limp on to the end of the Devonian and get wiped out in another extinction event that I sort of lump in with this one just because... In the Devonian, there's a series of mass extinctions that's hitting the planet, but there's
just the bad time.
Well, I mean, it's a really transformative time for the planet, because, and that might have to do with why it was such an unstable kind of crazy world, is that, I mean, this is the time in Earth history when plants and trees start colonizing the continents.
Right.
And
wait, yeah, you write a little about.
Yeah. I mean, they might have caused the mass extinctions.
Actually, explain that one to me. Yeah. I was like getting lost in the book there, but.
Yeah.
Plants actually end up maybe not being good for other...
Well, in the long run, they're great, but their introduction to the planet was sort of this... Might have been this kind of traumatic thing where...
Suddenly there's plants!
Yeah, for all of Earth history, the continents kind of look like the feed from the Mars Curiosity rover. And then all of a sudden, you cover all the continents with plants and trees. You're really messing with these big... plants... chew up the rocks and release a lot of phosphorus, which today we put on our crops because it's fertilizer, but it's thought that maybe this was, a lot of it was released to the ocean. And today the fertilizer we put on our crops ends up in the ocean and causes these big algae blooms, which cause dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Baltic Sea. And in the Devonian,
which is really kind of ironic that ancient ocean stuff is screwing up the ocean.
Yeah, right. But it might be the same mechanism where plants are sort of chewing up the earth and releasing a lot of phosphorus and causing the same sort of dead zones.
Oh, really? That's how it works. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then there's a big ice age at the end of the Devonian, which...
What? The ice is back?
Yeah. So trees and soils suck down a lot of CO2 out of the air. And so it might have actually been the trees that are causing this big ice age at the end because they're so successful at sequestering carbon. Like today we're trying... People are talking about planting more trees to draw down carbon. It might be the case that 359 million years ago, they were so good at that, that they plunged the planet into an ice age. But in the Devonian, sort of, there's this sort of famous paradigm about this tree explanation that was from Tom Algeo at University of Cincinnati and his collaborator, Scheckler. I think he's at George.
That maybe the trees and the plants were a lethal mechanism.
Yes. And I...
Which is an interesting idea.
It's a really interesting idea. And so I really wanted to talk to Tom Algeo, and I did. But this is definitely, I would say, it's the most mysterious mass extinction still. There's some people who buy the plant explanation. Other people will attribute it to something else. There is a big volcanic event that people are trying to date to see if it is at the right time, and it seems like it's somewhere in the ballpark. So some of these mass extinctions, it could be the case that you know, there's not necessarily just one cause, but you're just kind of rolling snake eyes 10 times in a row, and it's all a lot of things.
Yeah, I know it gets a little squishy, but we just know something happened there. So, you know, you're kind of spitwatting ideas,
right?
And the one that starts sticking,
there's another idea, even that it was invasive species that contributed a lot to this extinction because the land masses are kind of starting to come together. We're still before Pangaea, but things are moving in that direction, and so new things are showing up where they shouldn't be and wiping out local fauna.
I know you mentioned it somewhere in the book, too, maybe in the Permian, but sometimes the idea, I mean, we're always kind of, we beat ourselves up because we are maybe the destroyer species, and are we the species that has really screwed the place up? But there's no precedent in the history of life, but... there might be precedents in the history of life where it's monospecies.
Right.
It's not diversity. It's like one species is so successful they eradicate. Does that happen here in the Paleozoic somewhere?
I definitely try to push back on that idea because I think there are some analogs.
You mean the idea that we're the first destroyed species?
That we're the first life form that's ever like caused extinctions, which is
so
definitely,
we can blame
definitely,
other
not,
creatures.
Definitely not true. Well, yeah.
The mushrooms!
Yeah, but I think there's kind of lessons to be learned from the trees of the Devonian where they were really disruptive at the beginning, but then the world and them collaborated to make the planet even more rich in the long
run. But
so I'm hoping that model we follow rather than we're just this big
asteroid. Nearly as recognizable as we would think of a tree even back in the Devonian.
The first ones were really weird. They were these basically didn't have roots at all. They were these big, I think they're in like the horsetail family.
Yeah.
But so they were really strange.
I hung out with a paleobotanist who's trying to beat some of this into my head.
Yeah, and they didn't have leaves. They just had like these photosynthesizing sort of fiddleheads on top of them. And they were really strange at first.
I know if I could time travel back, I want to go to the Devonian because that's when our fishy ancestors crawled out onto land. And I think that's a pretty amazing transition, but it's how we came to be sitting here chatting, but we're kind of moving through the ages here. Let's.
I'd want to go.
What's next? You want to go fishing then?
In the Devonian, yeah, for sure.
What do you want to catch?
Well, you need some really strong line for those Duncolosteuses.
Do you want to land a Duncolosteus?
I think so. I think that'd be neat.
Hey, well, what are you gonna do with it once you land it?
That's a good. It's probably pretty mean once it's on the boat.
Can you imagine that? It's trying to like snap at you and.
Yeah.
But moving through the ways the planet can kill you, okay, we come to the biggest one, the big, right? All right, so we're talking the Permian-Triassic event, and I have written, the Great Dying kills off 9 out of 10 animal and plant species. Huge volcanic eruptions cause a carbon dioxide crisis. Trilobites, my beloved trilobites, go extinct here. And life is completely reorganized after this.
Yeah.
So let's dive into the Permian-Triassic extinction event. Peter, what happened on the planet and how bad was it?
It was really bad.
How bad? Come on.
It's hard to find fossils for 10 million years after this mass extinction.
What do you mean? Something happens and you can't even find anything?
Well,
like everything's dead?
You go from these weird coral reefs at the end of the Permian and then after the extinction, you get piles of bacterial slime all over the planet. So,
really?
And it's the first time since before the age of animal life that these things are sort of pervasive all over the world. They're stromatolites. They're the things that you find 3.5 billion years ago.
All the stromatolites kind of come back and...
Yeah, because there's
like
so...
That's all there is?
There's so little animal life. Like, what animal life does in the oceans is it churns up the seafloor, and it's hard to... Like, you can think about how long it takes bacteria to kind of make gross film in your bathtub. If you have things churning up the seafloor, that's going to disappear. But animals get so wiped out that these microbial sort of mat communities are able to flourish again and build these big structures just because there's not really any competition from the animals because they've been so hit so hard. So that's just one way that the rocks look really weird after this mass extinction that doesn't look like any of the others.
You wrote a piece in The Atlantic earlier this year on the Permian extinction, like how horrible it was. And you were driving through Kansas, I believe.
Yeah, right.
So you put me in, it's like, I want to see these scablands in Kansas.
Right, yeah.
How bad, how screwed up was the planet? Paint me a dismal picture, man. Let's go dark here.
Right.
It's the end of the world.
Yes.
As we knew it.
So what happens is that, so sort of just to set up the animal life that's around, this is before dinosaurs still, but you do have stuff, big lumbering beasts and things on land, but they're kind of these weird things that are more closely related to us than they are to dinosaurs, synapsids.
Our synapsid are kind of proto-mammal friends.
Yeah.
Our kin in a way. Yeah.
Right, our cousins, distant cousins. But there's weird big reptiles around. And then in the ocean, you have sort of a Paleozoic world still. You have trilobites and sea scorpions, and the reefs look like they have for all of animal history so far. And then at the end of the after the extinction, things looked totally different. And in the meantime, what happened was in Siberia, enough lava erupted out of Siberia that it could cover the lower 48 United States a kilometer deep in lava. So if you go to Google Maps today and you put on like the satellite view, you can still sort of see these brownish rocks all over Siberia. And those are what's left of these big volcanic eruptions.
How long do they blow?
They were going off for hundreds of thousands of years.
Hundreds of thousands of years.
But what's weird is that the extinction happens all at once 300,000 years after they start.
Really?
Yeah, so...
All right, so what's so going on there?
It seems like it happened, which is pretty scary for us, is that...
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I get it.
The magma underground starts hitting fossil fuels, basically. Because they're coming up through this, the Tunguska coal basin in Russia, where there's lots of natural gas and coal and carbon-rich limestones. And so it seems like there's a change in the eruption style where they just start igniting all this carbon underground.
But what you're saying, the volcanic eruptions actually ignite the ancient, the more ancient
right, yeah.
fossil remains, basically fossil fuel of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like right. what we're doing.
Yeah.
Is then it hits the accelerated button.
Yeah.
So the volcanoes basically start burning the ancient coals from the Devonian and
well,
the
yeah,
Carboniferous.
Yeah, that had already happened.
So all those big, big forests from long ago, they're fossilized then.
Yeah.
And this starts just spewing even more carbon dioxide into the air, like it's volcanoes plus that.
Yeah.
And then we see just everything. There's a cascading something.
Happens. Yeah. After hundreds of thousands of years, the volcanoes going off and probably being pretty unpleasant. Almost everything on the planet dies within a few thousand years. And there's indications that it got 10 degrees Celsius warmer. So today we're trying to stay at 2 degrees C by 2100. This was 10 degrees of warming. It got so hot that the tropical oceans were the temperature of very hot soup, as one paleontologist put it.
You describe mega hurricanes.
Yeah, hypercanes.
Hypercanes?
Yeah.
What, is this the heyday for hypercanes?
Well, I said the oceans got so hot, over 105 degrees or something like that in the tropics, which when you plug those numbers into climate models, these weird things called hypercanes start popping out. So a guy I talked to, Lee Kump, thought that one thing that was going on was you had the oceans were going and they were losing their oxygen because it was getting so hot. And when they lose their oxygen, these nasty bacteria that make hydrogen sulfide, which is just kind of poison swamp gas. You can find it in like manure pits. Sometimes people get killed by it.
The noxious gas.
It's really deadly at like really low concentrations, but it might have been sort of suffusing the ocean when it got really hot in this mass extinction. And then you also have these hypercanes, which are 500-mile-an-hour hurricanes, which is way faster than a tornado, and it's a hurricane.
Is there any evidence? I mean, can you
see? No, that's just a theoretical thing.
The computer says that's possible.
Yeah, and this guy might have been going on.
You have 500-mile-an-hour winds because the continent is so vast, is everything so hot.
Well, these would have been sweeping in off the ocean, and they would have been maybe sucking up all this awful hydrogen sulfide gas. So you can imagine.
Oh, wait a minute. So like, not only is it a hurricane of unimaginable
intensity, yeah.
intensity, it's full of toxic gas.
Yeah, so you can imagine if you're some poor synapsid hanging out on the beach, getting hit by one of these, it wouldn't be very fun.
This doesn't sound really like the planet's a very nice place.
No.
The planet is out to kill us.
It's not out to kill us.
What are we doing here? I mean,
it's just
I did come away from your book thinking like, wow.
Yeah.
We're lucky to even be sitting here.
Yeah.
I mean, that was my big takeaway. Like,
I think about that all the time, that we're lucky. And not necessarily the planet's out to kill us, but I don't know.
I mean, you paint some grim pictures, dude.
Thank you.
So basically it's killer volcanoes that then maybe ignited the fossil fuels.
Yeah.
So is that a warning sign for what we're doing now?
Yeah, I mean,
because we are hell-bent on burning fossil fuels till there are no more fossil fuels.
Hopefully things don't go down that road, but if they do, the Permian sort of shows you what the worst-case scenario is. And in some ways, we might actually be putting CO2 into the air faster than these volcanoes. So more CO2 came out of the ground than we could ever put into the air ourselves, which might seem to kind of get us off the hook. But it turns out for some things, for some processes, like this thing, ocean acidification I was talking about earlier, where CO2 reacts with the ocean, with seawater and makes it more acidic, that really is more about the rate of CO2 emissions more than like the total at the end. So we might be going 10 times faster than these volcanoes were in Siberia. Maybe. It might have been the same rate, but it's hard to figure that out in the rock record. So given the sort of uncertainty around these things, this really is a big warning sign in the geological record to say, don't mess with this stuff.
Well, we're kind of skipping forward. I'm always want to skip forward to the, are we in it now or not? But I want to get to the, we got two more to go, right?
Yeah. Well, the good thing is the next one's basically the same thing happens all over again.
There is this other extinction that happens next, and following along, if you get the scorecards, we get through the PT. But then I actually, there's the JT, the TJ.
Yeah.
And it's only 80% though goes extinct there. But once again, volcanism, carbon dioxide crisis, conodonts, which were bloody freaking everywhere.
Everywhere.
Go extinct. And it is the end of the Adiosaurs, and there was maybe a possibility of an asteroid strike.
Well, there's, for a long time...
That's what I wrote. Yeah, I'm reading off of my little chart.
People in the early 2000s, there's this sort of 62-mile circular system of lakes in Quebec called the Manicouagan Crater that some people thought might have had something to do with this extinction, but then they got better dating on it. And it turns out it was 14 million years before this extinction. So that was sort of a surprise to the asteroid extinction community, because this was a this is a crater that it looks big enough to cause an extinction and not much went extinct. And instead, there's this another volcanic event, which you can see if you're
in Manhattan. Where are the volcanoes this time?
Yeah, so if you're in Manhattan today and you look across the Hudson River, you'll see the New Jersey Palisades. And those are basically this.
Those are the volcanoes, the culprits then?
Yeah, so...
So we have the Russian volcanoes to blame, the Permian. Right,
yeah.
Now there's the Jersey volcanoes.
The Jersey volcanoes that you can find also the same kind of like magma dated to the same time in Brazil, Nova Scotia, Spain, Morocco. It's this huge... As Pangaea is tearing apart at the seams, this huge volcanic event is sort of happening on both sides of the Atlantic, but the Atlantic isn't really a thing yet.
Oh, right. The Atlantic is the newer ocean. The Pacific is the older ocean. Right. So the Atlantic is... Take that, you East Coast people.
But yeah, like the Watchtongue Mountains in New Jersey, where now they're just covered in sort of subdivisions and malls and stuff, that's lava from these mass extinctions.
So they were as volcanic eruptions spreading, the opening up.
Yeah.
Of the earth, literally, and the ocean then, too.
Yeah, it's about the same. It's around the same time that Pangaea is pulling apart. And it might be the case that the sort of crust was a little thinner, so maybe it was easier to...
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea that Pangaea was maybe the coming together continents cause it. But then as it comes apart...
Supercontinents are weird, and weird stuff seems to happen every time they show up. So I'm writing...
Right. There's a cycle to supercontinent.
Yeah.
Because it goes back before the Cambrian, too, right?
Right. And the previous time, there was a supercontinent was called Rodinia before animals existed. And when it broke up, it's associated with this crazy, crazy climate event called Snowball Earth.
Oh, right.
So it might have something to do with the supercontinent, but it seems like things kind of go haywire when the planet's dealing with these things.
Well, what I love about your book, I know I'm jumping way forward, is like you go way forward, you go into you go to the future, which is like, well, where are we going? Actually, let's talk about conodonts for just a second. We did mention them, and they go extinct then. And conodonts are used by oil people and geologists to date rocks, and they were flourishing in the ocean, and it took forever for people to ever figure out what they even were.
Yeah.
Can you describe them to our listening audience?
It's worth Googling pictures of them, because they're these weird little, some look like tiny little combs, and some are these little... I don't know. They're just these little spiky objects that are tiny. And it turns out they're the teeth of these eel-like things. But yeah, they're important for oil geologists because they conveniently change color from like white to more orange to darker, depending on how much they've been heated up. So it tells you about the sort of thermal history of rocks.
One of the things I love looking through your book is that you come up with some really good little quips or alliterations or little memorable phrases. Somewhere here you quoted someone saying, conodonts are like God. They're everywhere.
Right, yeah.
I thought that was great.
Yeah, that's from a book about conodonts I read. It was a little dry, but occasionally there would be good quotes from it.
Yeah, the conodont specialists, they have their... Yeah, they're... There we go. That was happening. I wrote that down there. I've got on my cue. Volvos or volcanoes?
Yeah, that's Peter Ward, actually.
Was that Peter that said that?
Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's Volvos or volcanoes making the CO2, the climate's going to do the same thing, basically, is his point.
That's what we're doing now, and yeah. In the past, it would seem to be volcanoes that were always screwing things up and throwing things into extinction events, but now we're basically creating our own volcano with Volvos and automobiles.
Yeah, I mean, if what the volcanoes were doing that was bad is making a lot of CO2 and going in the air, then climate doesn't care where it comes from, whether it's from a tailpipe or from Siberia.
The planet's only got so much oomph, and the carbon's going to go somewhere. But hey, Peter Brannan, what happened at the end of the Cretaceous? So we made it through the days of the dinosaurs. Actually, before we get there, though, there's a pluvial event.
It's before the Triassic.
I know. No, it's in the Triassic.
Yeah, I mean, it's before the extinction.
Yeah, no, that's why I wanted to mention it before the KT, because there are these little, the Carnian pluvial event, there was a previous guest we had on the show, we were talking about it, I'd never heard about it, but it's kind of interesting in that it rained in the planet, it looks like there's evidence I've lived in Ketchikan for almost 40 years, and I know about the rain event there, but it rained around the world.
Yeah.
What's the evidence to tell us about that?
I mean, all around the world, you see evidence for sort of dry-looking landforms in the rocks turning into these big lakes. The biggest, I think, river delta in Earth history is right at this event.
Really?
Yeah, there's tons of just erosion from on land, so just sort of weathering happening from storm, like huge storms, and evidence for that in Italy and the UK. So there's evidence for just tons and tons of rain. Pangaea is a very dry, sort of arid supercontinent, but then you have this weird episode where it gets really wet all of a sudden. It's a really interesting.
And then after that, the dinosaurs seem to flourish.
Well, tons of stuff starts to
flourish. Is that when the crocodilians have their...
No. So the Carnian pluvial event, you get the first like true dinosaur. Well, you get dinosaurs 10 million years before this, but they're sort of small and important things in the southern part of Pangaea. And then after the Carnian pluvial event, they sort of spread all over the planet, possibly because this, you know, the wetter habitats let them sort of hopscotch around the planet.
I like to think rain gave us dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to put it.
So it fits on a t-shirt.
Right, yeah, that would make a great illustration.
Only three of us would buy it,
though. Yeah, yeah. But you get the first mammals right after this, the first crocodilians, I'm pretty sure. First modern coral reef show up after this. So it's this weird event where, kind of like the one I was talking about earlier, where it's almost more famous for the sort of bloom of life after it than the extinctions. And I'm glad you brought up after the Permian Triassic, which is the worst thing ever.
But life comes back really differently.
Really differently. I don't want people to get the impression that this book is like overly depressing, because I just as easily could have made it about sort of the mass radiations that happen after the extinctions.
Yeah, well, every time everything's flattened down, boom, 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 boom,
yeah.
There's an explosion of life afterwards, it seems.
Yeah, and in some ways, the Great Dying was the best thing ever happened for us. I mean, it sort of gave birth to the modern world that we have still today. We have birds or dinosaurs and mammals and crocodilians and coral reefs. So that sort of came out of the wreckage of this really bad mass extinction.
Did you have people writing in after they read this book, like, Peter, what's the point of life if we're all gonna... Did you get a lot of...
It was kind of split between... So there's some of that, but there was also a lot of... I found this book strangely consoling in a way, which I did too, because I think geological time really helps you get some perspective on... I mean, it's easy to drive yourself crazy reading headlines today and everything moves so fast, but really stepping out of your own time, I find therapeutic.
In that, what, it's not so bad now?
No, I mean, I don't want to underplay how bad it is what we're doing now, but we are just a small part of a really long, interesting story. It hasn't all been leading up to humans.
Not all about us.
Yeah, the planet's been many different planets, and right now it's this one, and someday it'll be a different one. But I guess that can start sounding nihilistic if you go too far with it, that it doesn't matter. But
well, we're almost to the number five.
Okay.
So number five is, well, let's go there, the pluvial event, and the rain gave us dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs flourished, the big dinosaurs. We still have dinosaurs today because they're flying around the skies around us, but go ahead.
But they had to first, the end Triassic mass extinction, which is after the pluvial event, the dinosaurs were waiting in the wings, even though they do sort of radiate after this pluvial event. The planet was sort of being dominated by these
crocodilians. Well, wait, I did skip the Triassic. Yeah, right. I'm sorry.
So just in the same way that the mammals had to kind of wait for the dinosaurs to get wiped out to kind of take over the planet. There's still a lot of dinosaurs around. But in a similar way, the dinosaurs sort of had to wait for these strange crocodilians that dominated the Triassic to get wiped out in this mass extinction before they could sort of have...
There's another event.
We talked the Conodont one. That's the same one as the...
Oh, it is. All right. There's the Triassic. Yeah. Duh. All right. Okay.
So we find...
I'll blend the beer.
We've set the stage now. There's three.
So the crocodilians take a hit, though, at the end of the Triassic.
Yeah. They came in all different forms.
And the adiosaurs, which are different. Yeah.
They're considered in this like crocodilian.
They're kind of the crocodilian spectrum. All right.
Yeah, and they sort of held all these different niches in the ecosystem. And then after this extinction, you really only have these little like dog-sized crocodilians. And the dinosaurs, suddenly you start getting giant dinosaur footprints everywhere. And for the next 135 million years, they kind of run the roost until the asteroid comes.
Or the volcanoes. Or the double combo. Right.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So we get to the end of the Cretaceous 66 million years ago. There's one very bad day. But you kind of split the diff there in a way, because you go out to Princeton and you talk to the opposing camp. You talk to...
Right. I talked to Gary Keller, which...
is anathema to the asteroid people.
Yeah. And she's a very divisive figure, because she's been saying for a long time that the asteroid really had no impact at all, which I think puts her in a pretty small minority of people. She has an amazing biography.
You go into a little bit of that in the book.
Yeah, and she also doesn't shy away from giving a journalist very spicy quotes about other people in her field, which is, I appreciate, but it's one of the reasons why there's some people who didn't like that I even talked to her. But what was interesting in the book is that other people who weren't Gerda Keller were going to these big this big volcanic event in India that just so happens.
Right, so that's Gerda's premise, is that it was...
Yeah.
These are the Deccan traps in India. Basically, India was sliding around in Pangaea. Once it lets loose from Pangaea, there's a... Well, can you describe what happens there geologically in the volcano?
Well, yeah, India hadn't yet crashed into Asia and made the Himalayas yet, so it's still breaking off from Gondwana, which is the southern part of Pangaea. But a huge volcanic event, just like the other ones I was talking about, just so happens to take place right around at the mass extinction. So before, I said the Russian ones in the really big mass extinction was a kilometer deep of lava in the lower 48. For the Deccan Traps, it's something like 600 feet of lava covering the lower 48 United States. So,
still a lot.
Right. So it's not as big as the Siberian Traps, but this is nothing to sneeze at, this event. So,
and how long are they blown?
On the scale of millions of years. So they were going before the asteroid hit. And when I was researching the book, people were starting to take seriously this idea that maybe they were sort of just puttering along. And then when the asteroid hit, it messed up the planet so much that they went into hyperdrive and started... The most voluminous period of the eruptions might have happened kind of at the same time as the asteroid, and there might be some causal connection. Since the book came out, people are still working on this stuff, and there have been some contradictory results where some people have them really going crazy right before the asteroid, which just seems like a crazy...
The volcano's going right before.
And some might be too late to really make a difference. So I think the smart money is still on the asteroid causing most of the devastation, but it is just a bizarre... Maybe just a bizarre coincidence that you have this event, these volcanoes going off, or there is some connection.
Well, I think what you talk about in the book is that there's cascading events, that sometimes when things go bad, there's just another bad thing that comes along, and there's luck or fate or the devil, another thing comes along, and it's a cascading things when things get bad, and just when you're maybe recovering, there's another thing. So the volcanoes are going off, and then... Life is tough. This rock from outer space hits 66 million years ago. So you are there's irrefutable evidence at this point, right? I mean, even Goethe's accepting that.
No. See, no. That's what makes her like.
Oh, okay. So
the biggest outlier. She just thinks it was like, you know, the Earth.
It was inconsequential.
Didn't even care about it. Yeah.
But does she admit at least that rock?
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure.
Like, but it didn't do anything.
Yeah, she just thinks it was hundreds of thousands of years before the extinction.
Oh, before. And then.
I think so. I think that's. That